something that we need to just step into, that we've been talking for a few weeks about God's kingdom and what it looks like, and I think there's probably a very real sense that unless there's new wine, some sense of new freshness, that it's quite difficult for us to try and imagine a world where God is everything. And so thanks for that, guys. That's beautiful. For those of you who don't know me, my name's John, and I have a confession. I'm not much of a hugger. If you know me well, you'll know this. But I wanted to let you know that it's actually not because I don't like hugging, necessarily. I've just always found the practice of grabbing someone's torso quite invasive, and I definitely find it a little bit invasive. But I want to tell you a story. One time, I think I must have been lamenting about how depressing the world is. I don't know if you've ever been there. See, I'm an optimist with a slight propensity towards like existential nihilism, so I struggle occasionally. I was lamenting about how bad the world is, and I thought, what are some practical ways that I can begin to make the world a better, more loving place? And you know, just hugging people is a nice way to express love and kindness and warmth, right? And so we had this couple over for dinner, me and Nina, but it was that kind of awkward first date with a new couple. Have you ever had those moments where, you know, this moment will dictate whether there's a friendship in the future or how the friendship's going to go? And I was a little bit nervous anyway because those moments are awkward, and I don't do that well in awkward situations. And we were playing Settlers of Catan, so I'm not great in competitive situations either, because I just want to dominate and destroy everyone, because why would you play a game if you're not there to win? And so I was trying to find creative ways to win, but still maintain some kind of future friendship. And anyway, so we played, and it was kind of a nice night. I lost because I was trying to be more like Jesus. And then we went out, we kind of saw them out, and I was like, this is my moment, you know, to embrace the hugger inside. And so it's good to hug guys, because you kind of do the whole, like, you grab them like that, and like, ba-doom. It's not really a hug, it's just a ba-doom. And it's kind of cool. And it's a bit awkward, you know, the wife's there, and I'm like, how do you? So what I was like, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to make the world a better place. And so I leant in and I gave her a hug, and her body went stiff. And she literally said the words, oh, you're a hugger. And I just died inside, and in my brain, I was like, no, you don't understand. This is a social experiment. I was trying to bring God's kingdom to earth. I was trying to find more. You know, and I just, in that moment, everything fell apart for me. And that was a moment of trauma that I constantly look back on. So people make fun of me these days for being, but that's why. It's because it never works out. So it's always awkward. And so, but I have to be honest with you, the reason why I even attempted the hug is because there's something inside of me that actually believes that the life that we live, right, creates the world and environment that we're a part of, right? If we have lives that are warm and open and loving, then that's kind of the world we exude and create, right? And if we live lives of cynicism and bitterness, no wonder our lives are filled with those things. And so some of you know this story as well. This is another traumatic moment that happened to me a couple of weeks ago. I was in Coles, I think, a shopping center with my family. And I've got to be honest, like, a shopping center situation is not the most conducive environment to effective parenting anyway. So kids are all running around. I'm really stressed because there's all these people. I'm in the cereal aisle, and there's just way too many choices, and that's kind of overwhelming. And everything's, you know, it's just rough being in a supermarket. And then I walk to the end of the aisle, and there's this big guy with big beard staring at me. This happens to me every now and again. Like, someone will recognize me because I've preached or I do like online lectures, and so they're like, oh, John. And I'm like, oh, you. Yeah, great. Cool. So he's looking at me, and then I walk to the end, and he's like, shalom. I was like, oh, cool. Good. So you're maybe a Christian, maybe not, maybe something's wrong, I don't know. And I said, hi. And he said, my name is God David. So I was like, okay, good. My name is John. It's not as impressive. I think I clarified, God David or God's David? I was trying to put him in a box in my head, like, do I need to be worried for my kids? Like, is there something going on? And he just, you know, he held the awkward silence quite well. I was kind of like, this is all a bit of rude to turn away. So I was just like, oh, good, hi. And then he said, I'm from Bulgaria. I was like, oh, that explains the beard and the hugeness of you. I don't know. I know my name is God David. He said it again. And then he looked at me and said, I love you. I'm like, cool. Weird. I just want some Cheerios. It's really all I want from this place. And then he did the worst possible thing. He grabbed my face and he kissed me right there. And his beard was in my face and it was all, and it was just, I just stood there and just copped it. I think my body went rigid. And there was a guy, like another dad who was just there. He didn't help me, he just laughed. And then, so he, this God David, he just, and then he finished and he said, I love you. And then he walked off. So I don't really know what to make of that. There's a couple of different, you know, on reflection, after I kind of stopped sweating and convulsing, I was like, what on earth just happened? Either he is trying to make the world a more loving place in a weird way, or I need to call the police because something's going on. But that moment really, it's this weird moment. It's probably PTSD or something. I keep coming back to it. And I'm thinking, because I watched him to make sure he didn't interact with any children. But I was watching him, and he was going through shopping centre. Maybe not kissing everyone. I think that was reserved for me. But he kept going up to people and telling them that he loved them. And it was just weird, right? But strangely kind of nice. I mean, you don't often hear, I love you, from people other than your spouse or your parents, right? So it's a strange moment. And I think it's really important for us. You know, maybe that's not the best example, but the reality, I think, of our life, we're carrying on a little bit from last week in terms of our exploration into the scriptures. One of the things I tried to communicate last week is that the life that we live is kind of a microcosm of the world that we create around us, which is why it's fundamentally important for us to understand how loved and valued we are as people. It's important for us to understand it ourselves, and it's important for us to demonstrate that to others. It's important for us to understand how God sees us and loves us and values us. But far from being kind of a Dr. Phil sermon, letting you know that you can do this because you need to live your best life. Now, the reason that this becomes so important is because the only way that we're going to be able to make valuable contributions to the world, loving contributions to the world, is if we feel loved and then demonstrate it. I think that's a critical part of the process. I think if we don't know what it is to be loved, we find it exceptionally difficult to demonstrate that love to other people. In fact, most of the bitterness and resentment that's projected into the world is coming from hearts that experience bitterness and resentment. If our hearts and our minds and our souls are in disarray, then the world that we create is also in disarray. Does that make sense? And so if we're going to begin to talk about how to live as part of God's kingdom, which is a world of love, a world of peace, a world of hope, then we're going to have to find some sense of allowing that love and that peace and that hope to come into us, to understand how God sees us. Because this morning we're going to sort of wrestle with, I think, one of the most difficult passages of Scripture that we find in the Sermon on the Mount, and maybe in the Bible itself. It's the whole process of learning how to love your enemies. And we talk about that quite a bit here. We talk about how to love your enemies and all that sort of thing. And I think conceptually we understand that. But the reason I'm framing it in this way is because I think it's difficult for us to often love those that are even closest to us, right? Even more so to love those we've deemed unlovable. And oftentimes it all stems back internally. And so if you haven't listened to last week, I'll encourage you to do so as we begin to dive into this and learn really the practice of making the world a better place as we come to know how loved we are. Have you ever tried to find loopholes in the Bible? Have you ever tried to find loopholes in life? I was a terrible kid. I'd try and find loopholes in my parents' discipline so I could get out of, spanking, you know what I mean? Inconsistencies in their rules and all that sort of stuff. I found a couple of loopholes in the Bible along the years. One of them is at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 7:12. It's not on the screen. I just want to read it to you. So in everything, do unto others what you would have them do unto you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. That's beautiful. It's called the golden rule. Do to others as you would have them do to yourself. What's the loophole? If you hate yourself, don't love yourself, don't understand how God loves you and values you, then it doesn't really matter if you project that onto somebody else. It makes it much easier to hate, to resent, to be angry, to be violent towards another person if you think that that's what you deserve yourself. I think this commandment is not just it's kind of a moral imperative to be kind to other people. What we're beginning to see in the scripture is actually the practices that Jesus is going to be teaching us how to take the world that is filled with chaos, violence, hatred, bitterness, and reject all of that. But if we don't reject it in ourselves first, then we'll continually pour into the world what the world doesn't need any more of. So the passage for this morning comes in Matthew 5. We're going to start reading in verse 38. I'm going to try and take it slowly, but not too slowly. I notice there's a clock here. I think that's someone's leaving me a message, right? Katya's like, yes. But I don't know when I started, so I'm just going to say I started 30 seconds ago. So Matthew 5, starting in verse 38. Jesus says, "You have heard it was said, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you." This is a really interesting passage. I often find in life when we approach conflict and things we find difficult, we kind of have two responses. We have this fight or flight response, right? I don't know whether you're a fight or whether you're a flight. I think I'm a bit of both. I like to think of myself as a fight kind of guy. Like when I get offended or when I see injustice, I kind of like rear up. But then someone told me the other day I have academic arms. So if there's anyone bigger than me, like if God David started, like, you know, I'd be running. And bar my kids in the... So we often, when we come to different moments, we either fight hard, press in, or we run away. And oftentimes when it comes to understanding the scriptures, we kind of interpret it in the same way. When there's conflict, like they fight and they're aggressive and they're hostile and they win. We often think that that's God's perspective as well. But this passage here is often used as the opposite of that. It's often used as the flight, the excuse to run, okay? Because what a lot of people do when they read this is they think, okay, this is God's call to just be completely subservient and to take whatever it is people are giving you. Which is not at all what this passage is about. Because I think what often we find in the scripture is that our expectations, whether it be to fight, whether it be to run, are strangely subverted by God in new and creative ways. I think it's one of the reasons that this book is so powerfully dangerous, is because it takes all of our expectations and turns them upside down. Part of the context of this passage is, we have to remember, we're dealing with people who are living under Roman persecution. And Roman persecution wasn't great. There were practices built into Roman culture that were designed to keep anyone who was subservient to them humiliated. Just constant reminders that you're slaves. You're less than us. You don't really belong here, but by the grace of the empire, we're allowing you to be here. And oftentimes, what would happen was people would get public beatings, they'd have things stolen from them, robbed from them, or there'd be practices where they were, you know, had to walk alongside horses for miles and miles and miles, and everything was just designed to keep people in their place, to humiliate them. And as a slave, as someone subservient to the empire, you had a couple of choices. You could bow your head, take it, or a lot of people fought. They picked up arms and they started chopping people up. Barabbas, we see in the Gospels, was a man on trial next to Jesus. Barabbas was a violent zealot. He decided to take the rebellion to the empire and he lost because the empire was too strong. But Jesus, in this moment, is giving us an interesting alternative, one that requires us neither to just lay down and have people walk over us, but neither does it allow us to forget who we are by picking up a sword and repaying evil with evil. If you look at the first bit, Phil's talked in a few of his sermons about this triadic structure, this three-part structure to the Sermon on the Mount. The first part of Jesus' teachings, he's kind of highlighting how they always understood the world to be. This is the first bit where Jesus says, "You've heard it said, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." This is how everyone understood the world works. If someone takes your eye, you take their eye. It's a bit of a weird kind of language, but you get it. Tit for tat. Someone hits you, hit them back. Someone hurts you, hurt them back. That's how the world works. But then he highlights to them something, and it's really interesting. He says, then I tell you, do not resist an evil person. That word resist, if you translate it properly, it has the connotations of do not repay in kind. So don't fight evil with evil. Don't take violence and repay it with violence. Don't fight fire with fire, which is, I mean, practically just good advice. You fight violence with violence, you get violence. And even if you win the violence, you win the war, you win the fight, the world is no better. You've just won. Congratulations. Have you ever stopped to think about that? That our call in life is not to win the battle, but to exist in a way that brings peace and love to everybody. I used to go to a church, and they had really cool lights, just like us. But they used to have these big, you know, the big lights that project words onto the thing? And the words that were projected onto the wall were, "We are here to win." That was terrifying. I don't know what we were supposed to win. I don't know what we're supposed to win. But we're here to win. And I think that's really fascinating. That's how a lot of us live. But the reality is the only way to win is eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and just hope that you come out stronger. What's happening here is he says, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth is not the way to live. Do not resist an evil person, because when you fight evil with evil, what do you get? More evil. That's the world that you create if you decide to live this way. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. Now, we've done this kind of a few times in church. But what Jesus is doing here is highlighting one of the contextual practices that would often take place. A Roman fighting a Hebrew would come, and there's sort of kind of like, apparently, a way that you fight, and there's a way that you don't fight. Okay, for a Roman, you don't hit people with your left hand, because that's your ablution hand. Okay, and to fight with your left hand, to hit someone, brings shame upon you, because you're fighting with your poo hand. Right? That's what I'm going to say it. To fight someone closed-fisted is to fight someone who's your equal. Now, if you're a Roman trying to keep this dirty Hebrew in place, you don't fight as an equal. How do you fight? You slap them, okay? Slapping is reserved for slaves and women. That's what happens. So what happens in this, like Jesus is playing this kind of thing out, you've got a Hebrew man and a Roman soldier. The Roman soldier slaps him across the cheek. He bares his cheek, but he turns his cheek around, and the turning of the cheek around forces the Roman soldier to either hit him with his ablution hand or hit him with the fist. So kind of the way it works. I would demonstrate it, but the only person I feel comfortable demonstrating is Phil, and I don't feel comfortable in that fight situation. So I'm just going to... But I hope that makes sense. Roman soldier hits him as a slave. The cheek is gone, turns the other cheek, and all that's left for the Roman soldier is to fight... slap him with the other hand, or to fight him as an equal. It's kind of this weird defensive practice, which is giving the Roman soldier a couple of different options. Either you can bring shame on yourself by hitting you with the wrong hand, or you can hit me in the face with your fist, but then you've told me that I'm your equal. Both of which are extremely shameful practices for the Roman. There is a third option, though, for the Roman. He could just not hit him again. He could desist from this evil practice. I love the go with them 2 miles, because I've heard a billion sermons on it. Go the extra mile, work harder, be better, right? This is fascinating because, again, one of the practices that used to happen was a Roman soldier would see a group of Hebrew males and they wanted to break them up by humiliating one of them in front of everybody else. And so they'd get off their horse and they'd take the pack off the horse and they'd put it on the back of the man. What's the statement? You're as good as a horse. I'm going to give my horse a rest, and you're going to help me. And they'd force that guy to walk with them 1 mile. But it was built into the law. They could only get them to walk 1 mile. They didn't want people dying on them. So in this situation, I mean, just can you imagine that? You're there with maybe your family or your friends. This Roman soldier gets off his horse, takes all of his stuff, and puts it on your back, saying, "You're just about as valuable to me as a horse." And you have to kind of crawl back home at the end of the day and try and fit back into your family and your friendship after being humiliated and shamed. And so Jesus' option isn't run away, fight. He says, if they ask you to go with them 1 mile, why don't you just go with them a second mile? Because you see, the moment that you finish the first mile and start on the second mile, you're no longer doing it as a slave. You're doing it as a free man. You're doing it in service to the Roman. and suddenly all of the power goes from them into you. And you're doing it to help them, to serve them. See, this is a really strange portion of Scripture, because what Jesus is not saying is lie down and take it. What he's not saying is get up and fight. What he's saying is there are ways to resist evil that do not perpetuate it. But one of the conditions, I think, is that if we practice, there's a book by a guy called Walter Wink called The Third Way, where he brings all of these practices to life and starts to explain how, as Christians, to live as part of God's kingdom, we have to be continually on search for this third way, a way that is somewhere between passivity and violence, that always chooses peace, love, and transformation. But the key, and I think why this passage is so difficult, is that for it to work, for that practice to work, you have to be open to the fact that the one who is persecuting you and oppressing you might actually experience redemption in the process. This cannot be a kind of subversive practice where you're walking a second mile because you want to humiliate somebody else. It's the opportunity that you afford back to somebody else to change, to be transformed and redeemed. This is the difficulty of the Christian faith, is that it is our job to live deep, transformed lives and create environments where others can experience that same grace and freedom that we have. Our family, our friends, and even those people we despise. It's the most difficult part of the Christian faith, that we have to be willing to consider that those who we find most difficult, most unlovable, those who we would even describe as our enemies, may well end up in the same loving embrace with God that we will. I don't know how you feel about that, but I think that's quite difficult. I realize that I'm speaking this in a context where I'm not oppressed, I'm not hurting and painful, and I really haven't experienced the kind of trauma that a lot of people in this room have experienced, but certainly a lot of people in the world have experienced. But we have to believe that it's possible. And every time we talk about this, there's some interesting conversations that begin to come up. Oftentimes, what people do is they'll put you in a situation, and this is the classic one. It's a case of someone, what did they say to me once? Like, what happens if someone breaks into your house in the middle of the night, grabs your wife, and they've got a gun to her head, and the only way you can stop this person is by shooting him in the face? Okay? So that's, first of all, a situation, a scenario that's been created so that I will say that I'm going to shoot the guy to save my wife, right? And then I lose the ethereal argument and they win and it's all okay. Like that. But the underlying motivation to that scenario is, you know, you're saying we do not resist evil with violence or resist evil with evil. We're not being passive. What do we do in situations like that? Because that's really hard, right? Imagine if your loved ones are at risk and the only way you can save them is to engage in those practices you think are evil, violent, wrong. But I heard someone once take that scenario and flip it on its head. They said, what happened if instead of a stranger breaking into your house, grabbing your wife and putting a gun against her head? Because most people in that situation would be like, yep, done, sorted. I'll have to live with that, but I've saved the one that I love, right? What if it was one of your kids who woke up in the middle of the night in some kind of delirious, psychotic state, grabbed the gun that you have, and put it to your wife's head? Your immediate reaction would not be to fire that gun to save your wife. Why? Because you love both of them. You love your wife, you want to save your wife, your husband, whoever it is, but you also love your child. So the issue in the first scenario is not that we have to do violence, it's that we place value and love in certain places. I think one of the things that Jesus is talking about, one of the things that we find most difficult is, what would it be like if we could learn to love people to the point where we couldn't just pull a trigger? We couldn't just consign them to the outskirts. We couldn't look at them and say, well, of course you would say that. This is who you are. What happens if we demonstrated love for even those people we found most difficult? Maybe that's not what he's saying. But if you carry on in the passage, it says, you've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. Love your enemies. You see, if we could get to a place And I'm alongside all of you in this room who think that this is one of the strangest portions of text. And perhaps there's a level of naivety that comes with this, all right? Some of you are like, well, I live in the real world. And that's okay. But we're not talking about the real world. We're talking about God's kingdom. And God's kingdom is a breath of life and hope that we are trying in some way to live in this world. And what would it be like to stare evil and violence in the face and exhibit love and hope instead? What would it be like to believe that love is more powerful than hatred and that hope is more powerful than despair? Like I said, I'm an optimist in training. But I remember, I always feel a bit silly when I'm speaking about this passage, I have to be honest. A little bit naive, maybe. I remember teaching on it once, down in Bunbury, I think, and someone said something really interesting. They said, so my kid is 8 and he's being bullied in school, and my husband is teaching him how to fight so that he doesn't get pummeled every single day. You telling me that's wrong? That my kid should just take it? You know, you've got the violence and the passive. And I thought, first of all, it's like, I don't know. It's in the Bible. All right. Ask Jesus. But then we thought, well, let's take a moment and let's just explore that. Let's just try and understand. I don't have all the answers. I hope you don't think that I do, because otherwise there's a whole other thing. But we sat down as a group, kind of group of us, and we just talked it out. And one of the questions that came up is, okay, so why that kid who's bullying your kid every day, like, why? Why do kids bully people? He might be hitting your kid because every day he goes home and that's what he receives, right? He might be incapable of demonstrating love or kindness or compassion because he has never seen what it looks like. Maybe he's filled with bitterness and resentment at such a young age because that's all that he's ever been a part of. And you could fight that to protect yourself, that's fine. Or you could begin to ask the questions of what do we need to do in order to try and help? Yes, even that kid. And it was this beautiful moment where people started to realize, wow, there's more at stake here. What we need to do is we need to get your little 7-8-year-old son and teach him the gospel. No, that's not what we need to do. That's the naivety. But there was no real responses in that moment. But what there was a deep-seated compassion that began to emerge, not just for the kid who was being persecuted, but for the one who was doing the persecuting at the same time. Is there a way where we can liberate both? I think for this passage to sink into our souls, we need to believe that is possible. That there is liberation for the victim and liberation for the oppressor. Just leave that there. We move on to the next passage. That just follows on. It says, he causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your people, what are you doing more than anybody else? Do not even the pagans do this? It's like every God is for all of us. But I want you to see this moment as more than just a moral imperative to love people. I mean, that's what it is fundamentally, but this is more than that. This is a way that we can begin to reframe the world in which we exist. If we can truly see through all of the bitterness, resentment, anger, and violence in the world, if we can see through even those we've identified as our enemies to something deeper, what we'll be able to do is recreate a world where there are more important things than me fighting you and you fighting me. Let me take you back just for a moment. We dabbled last week in Genesis 3. Genesis 3 is a story we all know. It's a story of Adam and Eve, the garden, snake. And it's a strange story. I think we just need to be honest about that. And we were all a little bit confused about what happened in Genesis 3. I mean, a lot of people look and they go, the serpent, the devil. The devil was the serpent. It never says the devil was a serpent. It's just a talking snake. We make of it what we will. But it is fundamentally a story of tragedy and grief. This is a moment where God is trying his best to communicate who he is to his people, and they misunderstand in some way and choose another path. And I think what we see there is something tragic, but I think what we begin to see emerging out of this moment is human sinfulness begins to rear its head. But I think human sinfulness is seen most clearly not in Genesis 3, but in Genesis 4. So Genesis 3 is this confusing story where we refuse to listen to the voice of God, and instead we take our own voice, or the voice of the serpent, as more important and more justified. What that leads to is a story of violence in chapter 4. Most of us know it. Let's read it together. Chapter 4, starting verse 2. It says, "Now Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil." Abel and Cain were the sons of Adam and Eve. "In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruit of the soil as an offering to the Lord, and Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. And the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted?'" That's an important statement, because it indicates that Cain knew what was right. He just chose not to do it. You know, I spent a lot of time feeling really bad for Cain, because it actually says, Cain worked the soil, Abel kept the flocks, Cain brought the product of the soil, and Abel brought the product of the flocks. And to me, I'm like, that seems fair, right? But God says, if you do what is right, will you not be accepted? I think some of us live our lives as if what God is asking us to do is somehow ethereal, nonsensical, but if we get it wrong, we're screwed. Have you ever felt that? I don't know what the will of God is. It's this kind of, we use that language, and sometimes we go even a little bit further and talk about the perfect will of God. That's terrifying. And we kind of live as if the will of God is this tightrope, right? We step one, take one step in front of the other. We've got to pray for the next step. Where's the next step? The tightrope could change that. And all the while, we're like, God is so good. So free. We're so free. And we're like, everybody else, come and join me in my freedom. And everyone's looking at us going, I think you're insane. That doesn't look like freedom to me. It doesn't look like love. Because we know that if we step off, well, we don't even talk about what's going to happen if you step off the tightrope that is the will of God. That's not what's happening in this moment. Cain knew that he decided to go another way. But that's not the end of the story. What God says, if you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it. There's a choice in this moment. There's a choice to do what is right, and there's a choice to do what is sin. What is sin? Now Cain says to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" Now, have you ever had a moment where you felt like God was asking you a terrifying question that he already knew the answer to, but he wanted you to tell him? This is one of those moments. I think God knew. But he wanted Cable? He wanted Cable. He was bored. Cain says, "I don't know." And then he asks this question, "Am I my brother's keeper?" What do you think is the answer to that question? The answer is yes. But because of sin, he had so misunderstood the reality that he's existing in. God said, "Where's your brother?" Cain's like, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Am I supposed to protect my brother? Am I supposed to know where he is? Am I supposed to keep him safe?" Yes. Yes, you are. But sin has ripped you apart to the point where you've decided to kill your brother. See, this is what sin does. You see, the love of God binds us together and sin rips us apart. So to love your enemies is not just a practice of getting over yourself and loving those people you don't really want to love. Loving your enemies is a practice of engaging in a world without sin, where we refuse to allow anything into our life that would separate us from others, even the people you hate. It's just not clear to me at all that Christians should have enemies. I mean, I know that's a difficult thing to say, but it's not clear to me at all that we would have enemies, that that's something we're allowed to do. we talk a lot about the things we're supposed to do, and I try to steer away in my language from you should do this and you shouldn't do that, because I think that's what a lot of people make of faith, and that's not what faith is about. But if we're going to put moral imperatives on faith, maybe this should be one. You are not allowed to have enemies. Reconcile. Make peace. Try to love. Because when you love the people that you hate, we move away from this story into a different story. I find that moment on the cross overwhelming when God is looking at the people who've nailed him there and he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I'm one of those people that nails him to the cross, that betrays him, that looks away, that runs away, that fights when I should listen. And so those words sink deep into my soul. And I think the reality of all of this is we are not capable of loving even our loved ones, let alone our enemies, but by the grace of God. But when we realize how fragile we are and how graceful he is, and we feel that love and we feel that grace, and we can demonstrate it to other people. Which is why I kind of started off by saying, I think it's internal. I think it's in us. I think there's something broken in us that we need to allow God to fix. I don't think we can do it by ourselves. I think we need some new wine, a new understanding of God, something that will lead us into a place where we refuse to allow anything to stand between us. I don't know if you're sure if you're aware of this, but this is why we practice communion every week. Because you're coming before a God who has filled you with grace and freedom and love, but you're doing it alongside other people in harmony and love and peace. This is difficult, I think. And a lot of you sort of have people every year who are like, yeah, nah, this is too hard, this is too difficult. And maybe I'm being idealistic about my expectations of our Christian faith. Maybe I'm striving for too much, but I love the last portion of this text. Because if we can put it up on the screen, this is what we're working towards. Perfection. Now this isn't some kind of humanist discourse where I'm saying we are needing to strive to be perfect human beings. But let's not be under any illusion what God is asking us to participate in. He's asking us to participate in a world that looks perfect just as he is perfect. And in order for us to do that, we need to be perfect just as he is perfect. I want to finish by giving us an encouragement from Romans. There's not that many encouragements in Romans. But I find in Romans that Paul highlights so many tensions that are deep inside of me that he tries to reorient in us. Because when we're talking about this, it's almost as if we start with sin, right? Sin is here. And then this new kingdom that we're trying to work towards is here, new creation, right? Have you ever seen one of those bungee ropes? One of these like kids things where you abstract a bungee rope and you try and run as fast as you can? And it's comical because you never quite make it, and you're like, boom, fling right back. It's almost as if we start with here, with like Genesis 3, and we're like, whoosh, and then we get to a certain place, and it's like, oh, the bungee's tight, and then we're like, fling right back again. I wish you would get one for next week. So we could, some of you are like, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. That's how we live our life, right? We're anchored in this thing called sin. Now, I don't want to play that down, because there's an aspect to all of us that engages in this sinfulness. We do things wrong. Maybe we don't kill our brothers, but we do things that are horrible. But I want us to realize together that there is something deep within us that is not defined by sin, but is defined by God. I mean, I realize this as a parent. There's a difference between me looking at my children after they've done something wrong and going, you lied to me just then, and saying, you are a liar. You stole from me just then, and you are a thief. See, one defines the action and one defines the person. And it is my absolute conviction that we are not sinners by definition, just by the things that we do that are stupid. We're moving away, and this is Paul. And I read this and I felt so encouraged because I understand exactly what he's saying. He's in Romans 7, starting in verse 14, he says, "We know that the law is spiritual, but I am unspiritual, sold as a slave to sin. I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do I do not do, but what I hate I do. And if I do what I do not want to do, I agree that the law is good. As it is, I no longer I myself who do it, but it is sin living in me, for I know the good itself does not dwell in me, that is in my sinful nature, for I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing." It makes sense, right? "Now if I do what I do not want to do, it is no longer I who do it, but it is sin living in me that does it." This is confusing, but I also understand exactly what he's talking about. There's things in my life that I do that I hate that I do them. And there's things that I want to do that I don't do, and I hate it because I can't do them. But what happens next in verse 21? He says, "So I find this law at work, although I want to do good, evil is right there with me." Have you ever felt that? With verse 22, "But my inner being delights in God's law." This is where we come full circle. See, in order for us to be a community of Christians who can practice loving your enemies, you have to believe that there is love inside of you and that God loves you and that that is who you are. And here, after all of the sinfulness, after all the tension, after all the confusion, where Paul is saying there's so much stuff that I do that I hate myself for doing, he says, "But my inner being delights in God's law." There is something deep inside of all of us which screams out for God's love and God's goodness. And it's that that we need to find. He goes on and he says, "But I see another law at work in me, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin. What a wretched man I am. Who will rescue me from this body that was subject to death? Thanks be to God who delivers me through Jesus Christ." So I'm not saying we need to be perfect, but I'm saying we need to believe that together we can love as God has loved us. And so we're going to come around the table. I'm going to ask the band to come up, and they're going to sing that song again because that was a pretty cool song. And we don't do this that often, but I'm going to ask people to come forward if they want to be prayed for. And we're not going to make a big deal out of it, and don't be intimidated. I know some of you are a bit jumpy. But I think it's really important when we talk about something like this, stepping into a life that is actually fundamentally different to our own, to try and love like God has loved us and practice that love with other people, there's a sense in which we cannot do it in and of our own selves. But just like Kate said, we need the kind of the wind of God's Spirit to take us there. And some of us live such busy, crazy lives that we never take the moment just to step in that moment and go, I want that. I'm not there, but that's where I want to go. Supported by God's unending grace and love and freedom, and with the strength of his Spirit in my sails, I will move towards a world that looks more like Jesus. And so we're going to just come and take communion like we always do. So if you're distributing communion, please come now. This is a good time to come. And for those of you who are intimidated by music playing in the background, we're not trying to...